name is Tom Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week, it's summer. Big summer blockbusters out. So this week we had the option of MacGruber or Shrek 4 in 3D. We opted against any of those and instead decided to see something that just came out on DVD called The Messenger, directed by Orin Moverman with Ben Foster, Woody Harrelson. And we also are reserving the right to do stuff like that later this summer if we want to dodge what we feel are crappy movies. We will, however, next week be going to blockbusters. So this week is The Messenger. If you have not seen it, I, Tom Chick, heartily recommend it. We'll talk to the other guys in a minute.
Spoiler.
And we are going to spoil it, exactly. So if you have not seen The Messenger, go away. Go rent it, see it, fast forward to the 3x3. I am joined this week by Christian Milansky, I think. Did I say that right? Milansky.
It's Lara.
I also have with me Kelly Wand. Kelly Wand, do you have a tagline for our The Messenger podcast?
Yeah, it comes in the form of a request. Just to everyone who says they are always supporting the troops, please do me a huge favor and never support me. Thank you.
Okay. Now, Kelly Wand, The Messenger is not exactly a rollicking comedy. It's not really an action movie, but things do happen in the movie. So why don't you give us a synopsis of what happens in The Messenger?
Okay, so this dude, the guy from Six Feet Under, and the guy who played the Angel in X-Men, is like this, and the guy from Alpha Dog. This is all one guy, not three different guys. he has 3 months left on his tour of duty, even though he was in the shit. So Woody Harrelson recruits him, or wait, some other dude recruits him to be Woody Harrelson's bitch in this job where you have to tell people that their son or daughter's dead in combat. And, you know, hijinks ensue.
That works. Okay. That's a good setup.
And there's a wedding.
I think it's more like a reception, technically
speaking.
Is
it?
I don't think they're at the actual wedding.
That was my least favorite scene, but we'll get into that.
Okay.
Am I done with the synopsis? It's pretty weak.
Start all over. Funeral and a wedding. Yeah, one funeral and a wedding.
Damn it.
What did you guys know about this movie going in? Anything?
I thought it was Mila Jovovich and Joan of Arc.
Exactly. Now, because I keep screwing up, this is just singular, The Messenger, right?
Yeah, it's only about Ben Foster. Woody Harrelson's not in the title. Unless you see the movie about Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, so who is... Okay, so Ben Foster is the eponymous messenger. Woody Harrelson does not get titular billing.
He's the messenger's boss, which was a possible title.
That's too many words.
Hey, Tom, I agree. Oh, I like a podcast. What did Orin Moverman give us prior to this? I'm curious.
I don't think anything. I think this was...
This is his first movie?
I believe so, yes.
Is he a soldier?
That's a good question.
I think he's an Israeli soldier, wasn't he?
Ah, okay. Dingus has obviously done some research. What more do you know, Dingus?
Really, that's about it. I know that he wrote it, but he wasn't originally slated to direct it. And from what I read, it went through a number of different directors before winding up with him. And it wasn't necessarily his choice to direct it. I don't know if I'm right about this, by the way. That was weird for me because having watched it, it felt very much like a labor of love, like one man's project. Especially when I think he was an Israeli soldier, but I could really be wildly wrong about that. But it was written by him and somebody else, and then somebody else was attached to direct it. I think a French dude, which is why I think there's more of a love story in it. And then it went. It went by a couple other people and eventually came around to him. Now, I don't know if he wanted to direct it all along and just couldn't and didn't have the juice to be able to do it, because I don't think he's done anything else or hadn't. Or if it just finally came around to him and they're like, if it's going to get done, you're going to have to do it yourself. I don't know.
He wrote a movie called Jesus's Son. That's screenwriter credit.
Oh, which is adapted from a book, by the way. So he's adapted a... a book to a screenplay. He didn't direct doing... Jesus' Son, though, did he?
No.
That was someone...
He co-wrote I'm Not There,
The Bob Dylan
biopic.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's scheduled to rewrite and direct the Kurt Cobain biopic. I hate biopics.
There was already a Kurt Cobain biopic. We don't need another one. Gus Van Sant.
Which one? Oh, wait. Yeah.
It was not technically a Kurt Cobain biopic, though. It was more an interpretation. Okay, yeah, I'm with you, Kelly Wan. Don't waste this Oren Moverman dude on biopics.
Instead of watching Ali, watch When We Were Kings. That's my point.
Okay, exactly. Right. That's exactly right.
That's nothing against Will Smith or Jaden Smith. Ugh.
I do not want to see. I really like the direction in this. I would hate to see him just doing mere biopics. There's one point I fell in love with him as a director. I really like the script a lot. Of course, I like both performances. We'll talk more about that. But there's one specific shot where I was like, you know what, this Oren Moverman dude, I like him as a director. I will see whatever he does next, regardless of the fact that I love the movie. And it's a shot of Samantha Morton. After Ben Foster has come to her house and he's helping fix her car, and he's under the car, and it's before he tells her about the transmission, and it's this close up on her face through the screen door, and she's beautiful, and she it's shot through the screen door, so there's like a gauze filter, and she just looks lovely, and she's considering him under the car, and she tilts her head, and then we go to a POV shot of the camera tilting, and it was just such an affectionate perspective from this character. At that moment, I was like, well done, Oren. I'll see whatever you direct from now on. So let's talk more generally. Who here did not like it? Anyone? Did this work for you guys? Because I went out on a limb. I was like, you know what? I know you guys really want to see MacGruber. I know you really want to see Shrek. This I'm gonna say, because this almost made my top 10 last year. It had a short theatrical release. It just came out on DVD. I pushed for us to watch this instead of MacGruber and Shrek. You guys fought me tooth and nail. So I feel like I went out on a limb. Did it work for you guys? What was your overall impression? Let's start with Kelly Wand.
This movie was hard for me to watch. Partly because, okay, I'll just start with this. I vomited and cried during it, but I had the flu, so I was vomiting, crying before, and it just aggravated everything.
Okay.
But I did like, I think there's a thing on this podcast where it seems like we get what's the euphemism for attacked? We get flamed for talking about movies that, quote, no one's ever heard of, no one's ever seen, so talking about the awesome stuff like MacGruber and Shrek, because this is like your broccoli that you need to eat.
As was addressed in the movie.
There's no broccoli.
I could eat broccoli.
But that being said, I can see why people wouldn't want to see it, because it's so depressing and sad and harsh. But it's so fascinating. I'm fascinated by these people's jobs. I'm fascinated by their work and like the rituals and the truth. Like, I don't know.
Okay, I want to come back to that. Dingus, what was your overall impression? How did this work for you?
Hey, it's interesting. I don't find this film depressing.
I so wanted to say that. You're stealing what I was going to say, Dingus. Thanks for stealing my comments. Go ahead, fine. See if I care.
I'm sorry. I'm interested in talking about how this story affects the two main characters and how it's healing for one of them. Because I don't find it depressing, although it's difficult. I agree, Kelly Wan. It's difficult. There are difficult things to watch in it, but definitely I don't find it depressing. But that might be because I don't have the flu. I'm quite taken by this movie, and I've watched it a couple of times because thankfully it's on DVD, and one of the cool things about DVDs is that you can play them more than once. And I love the shot you described, Tom. That really struck me the second time through, just the way that the sunlight is washing out part of the screen, and you see sort of the top part of her head, and the way she cocks her head, kind of like a child or a puppy almost. The shot that really grabbed me the first time around is kind of a minor shot, but I just really liked it. It's when Woody Harrelson is driving the car and going after Ben Foster, Will Montgomery, after he's walked away from him, or he's driven away and he's going back to pick him up. And there's this shot where he's turning the car around, and the camera's inside the car watching him turn around. It's sort of a utility shot, but this film bothers to go with them in these little moments, like when he's on the floor in his bedroom, or just there are these little moments that the film kind of gets and kind of clues us into who they are and just the mechanisms of their lives. And I really cared about that. I think that there's a couple of scenes where the direction falters for me, but I think he's going to learn to work past those types of things with Oren Moverman. And I think he's got a really good storytelling instinct.
One of the things that I really admired about the way that this was directed and specifically edited, and it gets a little bit into what you were talking about, Dingus, with how much we see of Woody Harrelson going back to pick up Ben Foster's character, is the way this movie is put together. It's not a conventional screenplay where you've got this beat and then this beat and this beat and they're strung together. It's edited together where you drop into the middle of a conversation, you drop into a scene that's going on, and you leave before it's over. Things don't just start and then go through the point you need to know and then end. And it doesn't have a choppy feel. Instead, it has a very slice-of-life feel, like we are going to see the important part of this exchange, and we're not going to stick around and let it peter out. We've seen what we need to see, and now we're going to move on to something else. I really appreciated that it didn't... It breathed a lot, but it didn't feel like it had filler. Like it felt like it would drop us in the middle of a conversation, show us the relevant bit, and then just move out. I really liked the editing in this, the way it was strung together.
And it would also bleed in audio from the next thing that was going to happen. And I'm almost certain you brought this up, Tom, when we were talking about something else, some other audio. Mm-hmm. Design, and I can't remember what movie we were talking about.
We were actually talking about the Academy Awards and the difference between what sound design and sound engineering and sound production or whatever.
That was tedious. Spoiler alert.
But it's a movie I saw last year that I specifically admired the sound design, and it wasn't so much Dingus the way that scenes would bleed together, but it was the way that there was constantly ambient noise, like in in many shots, you got the sense that it was a world filled with noise and sounds. You know, there would be this terrible generic music playing when they were driving around in the car, or there were radio commercials, or sounds from the apartment next door, or an ice cream truck after the first encounter with
home on the range.
You know, the beeper, the sounds of the beeper, or they would have just one character when the two girls come up just talking on her cell phone. It was almost Altman-esque, you know, the way Altman would blend conversations together. But instead of blending conversations, it was just letting ambient noise intrude on the characters' lives and on what was happening. And my favorite instance of it, and this is just such a particular touch, is after the scene with Steve Buscemi, where they're basically retreating to the car. They get in the car. Woody Harrelson turns on the car. And then normally, you know, you would just have the sound of the car and they drive off. But as soon as Woody Harrelson turns on the car, a loud radio commercial about mortgages starts blaring. And Woody Harrelson quickly turns it off. But that's part of the sound design, is they get back in the car and they'd had the radio playing. So it's this dramatic scene, and you get a snatch of a radio commercial about home mortgages. So I just love the layered sound design that, and I mentioned it in our Academy Awards episode.
Well, it's all ambient music too, like The Wire, which you guys never saw, except for like once, I think.
Well,
the mortgage commercial. Oh, go on.
Well, it had a very long bit during the credits crediting all these songs that it had, none of which I'd heard of, except for the Willie Nelson Home on the Range at the end. But I was looking through all those songs going, good Lord, I guess, yeah, they had to license all this like generic rock and whatnot that played on the radio.
There's also this weird riff that they did early on that kept reminding me of The Doors, like this is the end, sort of Apocalypse Now, Doors music. I don't know if this is the end was actually in Apocalypse Now, but there's a riff that goes on early on when Will Montgomery's alone, I think, that was very evocative of the Doors. But other than that, it's just this loud. He's always listening to loud, like heavy metal kind of stuff.
Right, right.
Industrial. When he shreds his apartment like Martin Sheen did.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring that up, Kelly. So I one of the things, and Dingus, did you call this a, or no, you, Kelly, you called this a broccoli movie. I kind of disagree because this movie isn't as arty as I think it might lead you to believe in that. It starts really, like it's got a good, quick, effective early hook in that it starts a bit like something like Apocalypse Now or like a military movie. It begins with, you know, you meet the character, there's this almost frantic briefing, like it's very well paced, where he's thrown into this assignment, and then Woody Harrelson starts rolling out, you know, this is the job, we do this, we do that, we get in, we get out. It begins almost like a heist movie. You know, it's like something like Apocalypse Now, where it's like, here's the job, here's the assignment, here's the mission. And it's I think it's really intriguing. It's like, wow, you know, what is he in for? Because we, as the audience, are set up for this as well. You know, there are all of these rules, and we're about to see something that you don't normally see in a movie. So I think it has a think it has a very early effective hook. Like it doesn't feel like artsy or too like weird or it just doesn't feel art house in the way it begins.
Well,
it's almost I want to say real quick. It's almost like a variation on the young rookie cop, the old guy who's getting too old for this, who's on the verge of retirement. Like the guy who plays it by the book. You know, when they have their scuffle outside the store because Will has knelt with and touched the family. That's like the classic cop scene where the old by-the-book cop confronts the young rookie rogue. And that's kind of how it feels, I think, when it's ramping up early on.
Well, I qualify it as an art film, A, because no one has sex in it, and B, no one dies in it, which to me is a...
No one dies on screen.
You really missed it if you didn't notice the sex.
Oh, yeah. Wait, what? Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. I was throwing up during that. Not that I wouldn't have hit that.
And real quick, by the way, that was another great little touch. I love that, you know, he had this cute bartender actress, but later he gives her this great little moment, the I'm pregnant, I'm just effing with you thing. I love that. That was just a great, quaint little touch that gave this bar.
Have a nice life was her next.
Yeah, exactly.
That was pretty good. There's a lot of good lines. Okay.
When I'm talking about sex, I'm talking about Jenna Malone, by the way, not the bartender.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, and also the vocal sex when they go off for the weekend at the lake. So Kelly Wand, you're so dead wrong, Kelly Wand.
I'd be hung up on Jenna Malone too, and I kind of am after seeing that movie. I'm bummed. I don't blame him. She's right. He's right to be hung up on her. She's really hot. But you know what? The wedding scene was the scene that bothered me the most, and there's another scene I'll talk about.
Why was that, Kelly Wand? You mentioned that before. So what was wrong with the wedding scene?
It's not that it was badly paced or badly written or badly acted, but the groom, to me, did exactly what I thought he was going to do, and that kind of took me out of the movie a little. Because I like the movies like Dead Silences and long scenes, like where he's in the kitchen with Samantha Morton. I don't know. It's just like I like the art house stuff, and so when it didn't become an art movie – which you're saying it's like the scenes that were less arty. Oh, another prerequisite is you don't see the fights. You don't see the fight with the beach guys.
I love that cut, though.
Which would have been a slow-mo bullet time thing in the art house movie. But, yeah, it's just like that he was the groom in every, like, romantic comedy that you don't understand why she's with. And he's like, oh, God. Like, it would have been more unpredictable if he'd gone, hey, man, you know what? You're drunk. It's a wedding. Let's talk. Let's work it out. I don't know. It just seemed like, oh God, we got to get him out of here. But then they stay and they don't get kicked out.
He's totally good to them. What are you talking about?
And they have a table. No, he's not. He's like, ugh.
He's not like Bradley Cooper.
No, Bradley Cooper would have done that charmingly, but he was like, I don't know. I don't like guys with ponytails. There, I said it.
That's, you know, I'm with you there, Kelly Wand. That guy needed to, for his wedding, get a haircut and freaking shave. I was like, dude, you're marrying Jenna Malone for Pete's sake.
Oh,
my God.
Some
respect.
I know. Yeah.
Showing up looking like General Custer here. What the hell is this?
he gets her. Maybe that's why it annoyed me. I'm annoyed that Jenna Malone didn't marry me in that scene. That's pissing me off. But the other scene, I'm curious. Okay, I'm going to ask you guys a question here. The scene with the recruiters in the mall. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Those guys are just doing their job, even though they're pimps. Mm-hmm. And the messengers have a bad job. Like, what would you guys have thought of a movie about their work? Because I find that kind of thing really hard to take. Like, dudes trolling malls and schools looking for young kids to sign up to go die.
Well, I thought that was one of the scenes that struck a false note.
And those guys were kind of cliche, like, whoa, what? Hey, what? And then they were just out of the scene. Yeah, that struck a false note for me, too.
So you guys must be really happy about Kagan being nominated for a Supreme Court justice, huh?
Yeah, because she's constantly trying to get people out of malls.
she stopped recruiters from, was it Harvard Law School? At any rate, I did not mind that scene. Dingus, why did you think that it struck a false note, out of curiosity?
I just want to fuck some shit up.
I mean, you don't think that's what how a lot of 18-year-olds who join the military feel?
No, I think that
I didn't like the recruiters.
Okay, well, go ahead, Dingus. What bothered you about?
Sorry.
So Kelly Wand hated the recruiters. Go ahead, Dingus.
No, what I liked about that, and this is what I was talking about when I was talking about scenes bleeding into each other due to the audio, is that you heard them in the background.
Mm-hmm.
when Montgomery or Ben Foster was watching Samantha Morton and her son in the suit shop, and she's signing like the credit card receipt, and you hear this thing going on in the background, and it feels very much like layers of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt very real to me, that this is going on in the background where she's doing this and he's watching them. And what I wished and hoped was going to happen as it happened was that would just go on and it would not be commented upon. And what I felt was jarring was her walking down the stairs, or I think it was steps, not an escalator, was her walking down and confronting them and having this sort of cliched, you know, he's now in a box, why don't you tell them this, this railing against these recruiters, when she has otherwise been a very polite and honorable military woman. I mean, she says to them, I know this is hard for you. She shakes their hands twice. She says, now I'm going to go deal with my boy. She's very level-headed about all of these things. And then there's this very sort of soap opera-y explosion in the mall when I just didn't, you know, it just didn't work for me.
And I couldn't disagree more, because I think partly you're assuming too much. We've seen very little of her character, and we've only seen her character in shock. She is actually – Woody Harrelson says she is a head case. And he says it partly because no one has ever shaken his hand and said, this must be very hard for you. He highlights, I think, for us, the audience, that she's not reacting normally. And we have already – actually, we have not already seen, but we're about to see the broccoli scene where she is not in her head. And, you know, she says, we're ordering pizza. And then she says, you know, you can't leave the table till you've eaten your broccoli. And there's no broccoli there. I think it's established that she's a little unhinged. She's in shock. She doesn't quite know how to deal with this. And we find out more about it when we discover that she's actually already lost her husband, not in the sense that he died, but the reveal about her is that she had lost her husband long ago after he first came back and he was a different person. So I don't feel that was necessarily cliched or inappropriate or out of character, simply because we didn't know her character that much.
It's them, like, they were kind of dissing her, like, hey, man, why don't you get out of here? We're trying to do something. And, like, they're kind of mean to her, and then Ben Foster shows up. I don't think he's in uniform, and they instantly surprise. He is? Okay. And then he goes, come on, get out of here. And then they instantly leave. It just seemed really pat that they left instantly, and I was like, I don't know. Like, are they really that mean to grieving moms in the mall? Like, what? There has to be a routine for when that happens, because it probably happens.
They've got a
script. And they don't go, hey, get out of here, lady. We're trying to do some.
I just didn't. I thought that they were pretty. I thought that it was pretty understated. They just didn't know how to react to her. They were just trying to explain they were doing their job. I mean, I liked the whole interplay. I especially liked what you heard before Samantha Morton and Ben Foster come upon them, where they invoke 9/11. Love that conversation.
That's what appealed to me. Hearing that in the background is what appealed to
right.
me.
And, but it's like they're part of the same evil system. I mean, it's like they're part of the problem. They're like the reason Ben Foster's having to do what he has to do. And I don't think that was pointed up sufficiently for my taste.
Okay. Well,
so it annoyed me.
How much would, go ahead.
Wasn't bitter enough. Sorry.
Go ahead, Dingus.
I don't know that the movie is making a point about this being an evil system.
It is an evil system.
Okay, if you want to say that from an objective point of view, but I don't know that that's the point of the movie. I mean, they talk about that they support us, yeah, all the way. And
put it this way, I like the movie, and when it's in its Brokeback Mountain mode, where it's just about human beings, like the scenes with him and Samantha Morton, just like in the kitchen and the car. But then it becomes Crash in that scene. I felt like it was turning into Crash with the recruiters. That was a Crash scene, like a soapbox.
I think more about whether or not the movie's about whether it's an evil system. It's more about our ignorance of the system. When Woody Harrelson says, I think the every goddamn funeral should be on television,
yeah,
is really sort of what spoke to me. And not only that, I sort of think, yeah, these notifications should be too. We could never do that, and I wouldn't want to violate those families' right to privacy. But the idea is that we've become so lackadaisical about war and the costs of war. And I think it's more about that rather than whether or not recruiting young men to go to war is evil.
But the recruiters didn't act. They're not ignorant of the system, and they seemed ignorant. And that seemed like, whoa, what are you upset about? Why are you, ma'am, you got to go.
Well, I think they're just handling a weird improvisational moment, which is difficult.
But that's what the messengers do, and they have like a script, and they have a whole system in place for everything that happens, and Woody Harrelson has I'll take care of this if he strikes you again. But the recruiters had no plan like that.
Well, I do think recruiting, I mean, I don't pretend to know how it works, but recruiting is nowhere near as touchy or difficult a situation as notification. Recruiting really is, there are many ways that they do it. I mean, they do it through video games, for Pete's sake. But recruiting basically is to appeal to young kids, and it's to deliberately not misrepresent, but definitely not play up the sense of risk. Recruiting is, for better or worse, a slimy. It's sales. There you go.
Evil system. You're selling them death. You're selling them their own.
Let's talk about how much of a war movie this is. How much did you feel? So, Kelly Wand, do you think that there's a takeaway statement or an opinion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in this movie? Or did you just feel that was an instance where it sort of came up and it didn't fit?
No, it fit. I was more interested in the idea that Woody Harrelson hadn't seen combat, but Ben Foster had, but Woody Harrelson was the authority figure. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy between the war that we won being short, but it made the troops annoyed. Like, the fact that we won so quickly makes Woody Harrelson furious. Like, oh, I didn't get to see combat. I didn't get shot at. That sucks. So it's like, then we go back to Iraq, and it goes on forever. And then it causes Ben Foster's issues. But
let me put it
like a bad reason. I'm sorry.
Let me put it this way. Did either of you, Kelly or Dingus, feel that the movie had an opinion on the war?
No. But it didn't need to. That's not – I know I'm sounding like that, but – it's just about – it was about people, and that's what I liked about it. It was the parts where it deviated away from that, which – in the only two scenes that happened in were the ones I brought up. I like the scene in the bar where he's listening to the guy talk about Haji Wan Kenobi, and he's kind of laughing. Like, the guy's being a little callous, but he's laughing at first, and then when it goes sour, then – I don't know. That's a great scene. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite scenes in the movie, actually. And then the way it ends, where he's with the girlfriend, he's like, what are you looking at me for? Like, you didn't quite hear what they said, that kind of that textured sound you're talking about. Like, it's the things you don't hear that happen off screen.
Mm-hmm. And that was off in the margin of the frame, too, when you see that. It's around the corner of the building. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And since I like the movie, I should talk more about stuff like that.
Well, hold that.
Two things that annoyed me.
Dingus, what did you feel there was an opinion on the war here? Would you agree with what Kelly's sort of saying there?
I don't think there's necessarily an opinion about this war. I think for me it's about what war does to people. You know, Woody Harrelson has specific opinions about how this war is different from Vietnam. And he also has a lot of blustery things to say about how, you know, he was shot at too, and that he had his baptism as well. But he's got a tremendous amount of guilt as well. And I think this movie is about what war does to people who go and people who don't go. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more about that than it is about this specific conflict. Mm-hmm. But what do you think, Tom?
Well, let me throw this out then, and I'm curious what you guys will think of this. I, in a way, think that selling this as a movie about the war is a bit of a feint, like a sort of a fake-out. It begins as a story about... Well, I think ultimately, here's what I would say The Messenger's about. I think it's about the universality of grief in many forms and the variety of reactions we have to it. Now at first, this is very much a movie about the families of killed servicemen and women. And that's what it begins as. But as it progresses, it's about a lot more than that. It's about how grief is something that all the characters share and understand different ways. There's a very illuminating moment where Samantha Morton says to Ben Foster's character, after he's talked about his family, she says, "Oh, well, I guess your mother was your notification officer." I mean, she relates his father dying, which he mm-hmm. confesses to her, to their process of notifying people of a death. He then brings that, she brings that to him as something that happened to him in his childhood. Similar to the kid telling the Hajiwon Kenobi story, where he insists that he didn't know what Ben Foster was talking about when Ben Foster says, "Hey, it's like we're on another planet." I mean, this kid is obviously struggling with some kind of grief. You know, he's with this group of friends, and he, in talking, brings them down, and he has to get out of there and step out of there, and he doesn't quite understand what's going on there. The fact that Samantha Morton had, in a way, already grieved. She had already lost her husband before he was actually killed. That was her character's reveal. The whole thing about the shirt was revealing that her loss had happened many years, actually I don't know if it was many years ago, but had already happened before he went off for his final tour.
He turned into what he became.
Right, and that was her loss, and her grief was something that, this was like a different stage of it, a later stage of it when he actually merely died. But for me, the real payoff for this, I mean, where it really comes into this idea about the universality of grief, Woody Harrelson's character has not at all been through what Ben Foster's character has been through. And that's something that he reveals, that, you know, he didn't have a war. But you do find out that a lot has happened to him. He's been through a lot, and you don't find out the specifics of it. You know that he's been married 3 times, twice to the same woman. You know that he's in AA and that he's struggling with it.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the crucial moment of the movie, where Ben Foster confesses what actually happened to him, you know, where he tells this story where he reveals that he feels guilt for stuffing the guy under the car where the IED was located, the grieving that happens there, the payoff, does not belong to Ben Foster. He goes into the other room, and it's Woody Harrelson that mm-hmm. breaks down. It's through, you know, it's where his grief emerges, listening to someone else's story, you know, vicariously experiencing the guilt and the story that Ben Foster has told. That's where, and we don't know what Woody Harrelson's deal is. I think he's still an enigma by the time the movie is over. It's Ben mm-hmm. Foster's confession that sort of lets his grief culminate and come out. And I love the mm-hmm. fact that they have to stand in separate rooms to let that happen. So for me, ultimately, the movie begins about lost servicemen and women, about what that does to their family, but what it becomes a movie about is this experience of grief and how we share it, how it's separate, how we experience it differently for different things, and that's how I would characterize it.
You just said a lot of smart things, and I like the idea that Woody Harrelson, right before he gets up, before Ben Foster gets up in that scene after the confession, is still kind of talking braggadocio to him before he breaks down, like, "Yeah,
you're a real hero.
You don't even yeah.
That's a hero in my book." Or, yeah.
And by the end of the movie, we don't know whether Woody Harrelson is drinking again or not. But somehow,
I love that.
I like that.
I like the line about this fake beer tastes like laundry.
Yeah,
I love.
Was that
I love
a real beer?
No.
Not at that point.
Yeah. Not at that point.
I got the sense that he was trying to, because I don't think you necessarily know that until he points out that it's the fake beer.
I thought it was a real beer, and he was doing a complicated joke. And I go, wow, that guy's really, he's really drunk. He thinks he's drinking near beer.
Well, he never drank anything stronger than pop.
Right. He called it Pepsi, though, too, or something. Or my.
His joke was, I never drink anything stronger than pop. My pop doesn't taste anything.
Oh, I just now got that, Dingus. Okay. Okay. Now I get that.
But he was constantly talking in that way. And one of the things I love about his performance, and Ben Foster comments, or Will Montgomery comments on it when he says, it's all fortune cookies to me, sir, is the way Woody Harrelson, to me, you know, and you see it in that mess hall scene, which is a brilliant place to stage the rules, or the setting up of the heist, whatever you want to call it, the rules scene, mm-hmm. where he's talking to Ben Foster and demanding that he look at him. I always get the sense from him that he's putting on an act, or he's doing what he thinks the person in this situation is supposed to do. Like, for him, almost this is a scene, and he's acting this way because he's come to understand that this is the way a captain is supposed to act when he's talking to a sergeant when he's breaking this man in. And there's this sense of bluster about him and this sense of fortune cookie wisdom that he's constantly falling back on because he doesn't really know how to act like a real man. And I really love that moment that you bring up, Kelly, when right before he breaks down, he's still trying to fall back on that.
Yeah, because it's his mode that he's automatic. And also how he kind of talks shit about the Samantha Morton character to Ben Foster. Like, oh, yeah, man, that she's such a head. Yeah, how's that going? And then he's also, where he tells Ben Foster that he bets him he's still got his girl's picture. And Ben Foster throws him the wallet. And then he calls her shit. He deliberately misnames her. Calls her by the wrong name. Yeah.
Do you guys really think, though, that there was the sense that he wasn't, or Dingus, I think you said that he didn't know how to be a man, or like it almost sounds like you guys are disparaging him. Like Woody Harrelson's character. I got the sense that he was very good at what he did.
I wouldn't have used Dingus' turn of phrase. I don't think it was a lack of manliness.
I'm not disparaging Woody Harrelson. I think that's part of his characterization.
No, the character. I mean, the character of Stone or whatever, Ray Stone, whatever, Anthony Stone, Tony Stone.
You know, I get the real sense, and there's nothing to support this because he is something of a cipher. I think that, I don't know if you used that word, but you said something like that at the end.
Enigma.
An enigma. That he is a coward. That he didn't, you know, he says he didn't get a crack at the new war. Well, he's at the right age. He could have,
and he's doing something that requires a lot of bravery. What he's doing is extremely brave, telling grieving loved ones. That's pretty hardcore. I'd rather get shot at, personally.
I just resist that, partly because... So here's my own personal baggage. My family on my mother's side runs a funeral home back in Arkansas, and my mother has dealt a lot with terminally ill people and in stages of grief that when you're terminally ill. And I see grief, and this is borne up by, you know, my family running a funeral home, my mother dealing with terminally ill folks. Grief is a process that is often helped by ritual, by, you know, that's one of the great things that religion does for people in grieving, and by codes of conduct. And, you know, a funeral is not for the dead people, it's for the living, it's for the people who remain behind. And I got the sense that Woody Harrelson's character, rather than being cowardly or ineffectual, that he's just really hard-coded in this military rules of conduct for how to present this terrible news and how to best help someone who's grieving. You know, he even says things, like I thought it was, I love the line where he says, I used to introduce myself, but now I don't anymore because it's not about me. It seems like he has a very clear sense for how best to present people, to enter people into the ritual of grieving. And he speaks very, like he talks about the military really caring for families. So I kind of resist, Dingus, some of what you're trying to get at for that reason, is that I felt like he was very competent and very skilled, and he developed these skills to help people through the rituals of grieving.
No, I think that he's very competent.
I think he's very good at what he does. He's good at this thing. But I think he's also putting on an act on how to be the hard-ass captain to this sergeant. I get the sense that he's pushing some of those things and being a deliberate hard-ass because that's how he sees his role. And that isn't necessarily who he is. And in his breakdown at the end, I think you see that spilling out. That's what impresses me about the performance.
You also see it, Digus. I love the moment where he calls Ben Foster on the phone, and Ben Foster says, where he's you know, set off his beeper, and he calls him on the phone, and he's saying, "Hey, what are you doing?" And then his beeper goes off, and he's like, "Yeah, you're a funny guy. You just hit my beeper, didn't you?" Like, I love that he thinks they're like joshing around, playing with each other at that point. And then I love further the fact that he's doing this after he's just had sex with a bartender, and she's in the same room. Mm-hmm. He does come across as like a goofball looking for a friend at that point.
And then she has a great line. She goes, "What do? Deliver babies?"
Yeah.
It's like the opposite of what he does.
Nice. Very good.
And he's scrambling in that conversation on the phone where he's like, "What's your email? Do you IM?"
Yeah. Do IM is great.
It was so weird. It was so jarring when he gets the actual page, gets off the phone, and then the next shot after Ben Foster's shot is him telling her to get out of bed. It felt like a mismatched scene. It felt like This is two different scenes, and they threw this in. It was so odd that he was, like, standing in that closet, and it looked like he'd been working out. It looked like there was, a chin-up bar there, and then he walks in, and he's kicking her out of bed. It's so odd.
Mm-hmm.
He's also not...
Why does she have to go? Why can't she stay there?
If he has to go, she has to go.
Yeah, he's done with it. He's also not much of a fighter. I love the... hey, ladies, what floor are you girls with? And then we cut to them having gotten their asses kicked pretty much.
No, they were outnumbered. They won the low fight. Charges. Just in the other guy. I thought they won that fight. That's an odd – you totally got a different perception from when I got
– Well, he's apologizing. They're in the car, and he's like, "Sorry about that."
Yeah.
Do you own the lake?
Let's talk about Ben Foster then. One of the great early touches. So Ben Foster is just great. I just can't say enough good things about this guy. He's one of these guys I watch and I'm like, wow, I'm glad he's as young as he is, because by golly, we've got another, 30, 40 years of great Ben Foster performances. One of the early touches that I love is the scene where he's having dinner with Jenna Malone. The way he eats, the way he is just shoveling food unceremoniously into his mouth while talking with her.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such a great character choice.
I thought that was like how a soldier eats.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And similarly, go ahead. Well, I was going to say similarly the way that Woody Harrelson wore his watch and would look at it, like underhand. Mm-hmm. That just seemed so like military and cool. That made me want to wear my watch that way, and I don't even wear a watch.
I like the way Ben Foster uses his eyes in this, who he will look at and who he won't look at and when,
mm-hmm.
And obviously he's got an eye problem anyway, and he's working with that as an actor. You know, he's working with sort of the physical aspects of what his eye problem is and why he has to use the drops and how they're dry and how they're spotty. Mm-hmm. But, he doesn't look at Jenna Malone in that dinner scene. He's just tucking into his meal and he's protecting it like an animal, and like he could be called away at any minute. He's just shoveling it in. He doesn't make eye contact with her. And that plays out in the mess hall scene where Woody Harrelson is saying, "Look at me, Sergeant," and he has to be told twice to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the extreme amount of eye contact between Samantha Morton and Ben Foster in the best no first kiss scene ever. I just really love the way he uses his eyes.
I want to read a line from another movie that came to mind when Ben Foster was doing this stuff with his eyes. He had a condition that was referred to as granulated eyelids, and it caused him to blink more than usual, as if he found creation slightly more than he could accept. Anyone? Anyone know what that's from?
Cormac?
It does sound Cormac McCarthy-esque.
Or Terrence Malick.
Do you guys really not know? Dingus, you get that, don't you?
No, I refuse to.
Oh, it's from Assassination of Jesse James. It's some of the prose directly from the novel. That's spoken during the sort of the early shot of Brad Pitt looking out over the prairie. But I got that sense that, that's, he had this condition where looking at reality, he was trying to shut reality out. And it opens, by the way, with a shot of him kind of fake crying you know, these fake mm-hmm. tears coming out of his eyes because he's dropped put the drops in there. Right. But yeah, I love that character detail.
And when he stares at Jenna Malone and she stares back at him for a long time when he gets to the reception, like, yep, remember?
You just thought she was hot. That's why you liked her.
And her hair.
She was a child actor. You can't.
She doesn't belong with that dude. That ponytail asshole. You gonna say Tom? Sorry, Jenna Malone.
She's a little sister. Stop it.
You keep talking about Jenna Malone. I mean, Samantha Morton to me is so radiant, and I loved her. Like, I think she had just been pregnant, but I just loved how, like, this is gonna, I don't mean to sound condescending, but I just loved how real her body seemed in mm-hmm. this movie. She was just so curvaceous and not, she wasn't like a Hollywood actress on a diet. She just mm-hmm. looked like a real person. She got a bit of a tummy, and I was like, that, you know, she looks luminous in that movie. Jenna Malone, yeah. too. That was my thinking. Samantha Morton was just so adorable.
I also really, really love that Samantha Morton didn't put on this ridiculous Southern accent. So often that kind of, like, especially if somebody, where is she from? Is she from England?
She's British. Sure. She's very British.
Yeah, she's British. And when you're trying, the easy thing to do is to just slip on a generic Southern accent.
Dingus, can you do a little of that for us?
I'm doing it right now. I'm from Virginia. This is my Virginia accent.
That's hot.
Y'all come back now, you hear? I just loved that she just was very straightforward, and I just loved the way she did that. And luminous is the perfect way to put it. And I will just forever remember that shot that you mentioned of her looking through the screen.
Yeah.
She was also the only girl, though, that he delivered the news to. So it's not like she had any competition.
That's not true.
It's not true. The first one was a girl, although Woody Harrelson had to do it.
And there was a girl in the room behind the Hispanic dude. Actually, I don't know if that was a little girl or a boy on the floor back there.
It was a baby.
So
can you guys help me just logistically? Why was that last notification in that store? I think it was a nursery or a grocery store. I think it was a nursery. Why did it take place in there?
Well, I think the idea was they were driving to those people's house, and just as they got closer to the house, it was like, hey, pull over here. I'm going to get something to drink. And it just so happened that the family, and this doesn't seem that contrived if you think of it as a small community, that the family was coming through the store at the same time they were there on the way to the family's house.
Well, that's fine, but it just seems completely inappropriate to do it there.
Well,
it seems so weird,
yep.
Almost like, for me, it almost felt like something the director was springing on them. And I don't know how they staged these things, but the sense I get is that the actors just got thrust into these notifications together and had to do the scene. That maybe that was part of the director's, Oren Moverman's, technique was just, okay, you guys don't know each other, just go into the scene and do it. And the sense I got in that store scene was almost that he had sent Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster in there, and he's like, okay, we're going to have a scene in the store. You guys just go in there. And then he sent the people in, knowing that this notification scene was coming, because Ben Foster's so surprised. Oh, that's your name? Oh, okay. And then he starts laying out the notification. It was so weird.
Well, I can't imagine it wasn't in the script, but I did hear Woody Harrelson in a Fresh Air from a couple weeks back, or about a week ago, specifically for the DVD release, explaining that the way they shot the scenes, and it was very clear, and I love this about the scenes, was that it was one take, one camera, no blocking.
What? One take?
Yeah. I mean, there weren't different takes cut together. I mean, they might have shot different ones, but they used one take, and I'm sure they would take footage, because a lot of times it would focus on Ben Foster. I like that about the scenes as well.
Anything about rehearsal?
So I think he did say that they didn't always know what actors they were going to be talking to. So I think, yeah, there might have been some of that. Because, you know, you got the Wish You Didn't Have So Many Freckles girl. I recognize the guy playing her father. He's a character actor, certainly Steve Buscemi. As a matter of fact, he might have said that Samantha Morton is the only person they knew in advance was going to be doing the scene with them. I could be wrong about that. But it's very clear, though, that it is one continuous shot with one camera, and that it does seem like the blocking isn't stagey at all, which I liked about it.
The part that seemed stagey was when they were going past the park and everyone was staring at them. I was like,
I loved that.
That was great.
loved that. It was so clear, those women, are they there for me?
Yeah.
Oh,
and I think Woody Harrelson said, at least it's not Christmas or something like that.
Right.
There was a sense that those women were at the fence that, are those guys here to talk to me? And that was great.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I meant by stagey.
Well, I loved in Samantha Morton's scene when she talks about the shirt and we find out why the shirt was hanging out there. That was a little awkward because it again seemed like something they didn't really block, but I liked that about it. It seemed like the poor guy manning the camera was a little bit lost at times, and it kind of worked. Like, he didn't quite know how to frame the shot. At one point, Ben Foster goes over and looks at after Samantha Morton's left and looks at the stuff on the fridge, and the guy has to adjust the frame a little bit. And then when Ben Foster sits down, the camera has to go with him. I kind of thought that worked very well in some of those scenes. And that scene, too, the scene with Samantha Morton and Ben Foster, where we find out about the shirt, where it's mainly him listening to her, where they're standing at a window, so they're backlit, and Samantha Morton is looking out the window a lot. You know, you don't get to see her face during a lot of the scene. And then finally she turns around, you can see her face when she leans against the counter. But I loved how kind of rough-hewn that felt as far as how it was shot. And also between the actors, it reminded me of, there's a scene in Monsters Ball that's kind of famous because I think it is dreadful, where Halle Berry and Billy Bob Thornton, it's the Make Me Feel Good scene where they have sex. Everything that is clumsy and stupid and false and just overwrought about that scene is done perfectly in this scene with Ben Foster and Samantha Morton. And I just kept thinking of the contrast between those two. And the first time I was watching The Messenger, I was like, oh, God, please don't you guys have sex. I mean, this would just be so grossly inappropriate. You know, this movie's come this far. I trust that it's not going to turn into a sex scene because that's going to seem weird, and it's not going to be the kind of movie I thought I was watching, and I don't know that I really want that. And, yes, they didn't do that.
Well, the point of the Monsters Ball scene was you get to see Halle Berry's knobs.
I suppose if that's what you were in it for.
That's why everyone likes it. I don't know what you're talking about.
Didn't you want to rent Swordfish?
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I was so pleased that that's how the scene worked out, that they were so close and just so close and so close, and they just kept avoiding it. And she was finally said, I can't. I'm sorry. I just can't do this. Yeah. And I was so relieved.
There was a point at which it looked, yeah, I agree. It totally was not cliche.
Yeah.
And the cliche for the Haji, like, if it had been a cliche movie, the Haji Wan Kenobi scene would have been him getting mad and, like, going over there and drunkenly starting shit with the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
That would have been the stupid movies.
That scene so did not go where I thought it was going to go. I loved that.
Yeah.
Start talking about, you can hear the guy's lung deflating and the way the room sort of ices over.
Yeah. It's like the guy was kind of like hating himself for telling the story, or he was punishing them with the story.
And even then, you know, when he's sharing a cigarette with Ben Foster, you know, the scene where he didn't, Ben Foster's trying to reach out to him, and he's like, I don't know what you're talking about, man. Like, I love that it did that too.
the one thing I want to talk about, the one bit of staging that kind of threw me a little bit was that the final scene with the two of them on the couch when Ben Foster does his confession. It was such an odd choice to me, and I guess this is part of what you're talking about, Tom, the desire maybe to do things in as few takes as possible with as few setups as possible. Because that type of staging, two guys sitting on a couch staring straight ahead, is what you have to do when you're on stage. You know, you have to have sort of that artificial kind of thing often, where they're looking out at the audience. But, you know, when I've had conversations like that with other guys or whoever, it feels like that takes place over a table or across a room. And it was so odd to have them both sitting on a couch together.
Well, they're watching TV, you know.
Yeah. Oh, and they didn't know they were going to have that conversation.
It's while they're watching TV, and you actually, I'm not sure how I feel about this, but there is a muted tornado on the screen in front of them. Do you guys remember that?
They're watching
a
series.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like a gigantic tornado.
But it's clearly, I mean, it's like, I don't know how much to read into this, but it's clearly, yeah, exactly, Kelly Wand. It's a big shot of a tornado destroying these houses and the word muted, you know, on the TV screen. I'm like, oh, is that subtext?
I saw that as subtext, and I saw the mortgage commercial as subtext. Like, oh, no one has money, and we're all off the war.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously what you're going to show on the TV screen, and it was a separate shot, that's intentional. So the fact that it was a muted tornado, there's something there.
No one's watching war footage or war news. It's always mortgages and tornadoes 24/7.
But you're right, thing is, it looks awkward. And Woody Harrelson looks uncomfortable. Like, he doesn't quite know what to do when the story's unfolding. And he doesn't quite know when to eat. And at one point, he makes a choice. He's wiping his mouth with the napkin. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. It's watching actors work with that. Like, what are you going to do? You're watching TV, and the guy starts spinning out the story while you're eating. I loved that, in all of its awkwardness, and how that awkwardness then, of course, plays out into the end of it, where they have to retreat to separate rooms.
Yeah, you like that?
You know, it's just so odd the way it plays out to me. It's wonderful, and I see what you're saying, Tom, because what do? Do you turn to face the guy? Do you put your arm up? No, I mean, what do you do? And the way that moves, like, you know, to Ben Foster on the other side of the wall and Woody Harrelson breaking down, then Ben Foster going to her and them going in the house, and then the end, how that all sort of beat to the end of the movie has such an odd resolution to it, or lack of. I don't know how I feel about that, about them going into the house and those things leading up to that, the confession, the breakdown, the, you know, him going to her house and them going in.
That's at that point, Dingus, it's squarely in art house movie territory. You're right.
Ben Foster's character likes to stand alone in kitchens.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, Mary Free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody has.
Can we do a 3x3?
What?
I didn't want to cut us
off. Damn it.
Did we have more stuff?
It's hard to talk about this movie. You just get everyone go see it, and then, you know, I don't know. It's one of those movies I don't like to dissect. It's like, it is what it is, and if you talk about it and listen to a podcast about it, you're ruining it. Let's do it 3x3.
I thought we got a good hour. I hope I didn't cut off anyone's good points, but that was a good segue line, Kelly Warren. I couldn't resist. So for those of you just tuning in, we all love The Messenger. You need to see it and then go back and listen to our podcast. So there you go. So let's do a 3x3.
Don't watch it with the flu. Spoiler alert.
Whose turn was it for a 3x3? Christian Mazansky. I think it's your turn. So, Dingus, what was your 3x3?
I missed what you just said. Oh, what was my 3x3?
Yeah. Why don't we introduce for it?
It's our three movies that were recommended by other movies. So Tom's analogy from last week was Russian nesting dolls. So basically, a movie.
What movie's that?
You found within another movie. Either they're watching it or they're quoting it or however you wanted to game it, but a movie recommended by another movie.
I didn't like this at first. I was like, good Lord, I had a great one when you mentioned it. And then I had a tough time thinking of them. And I love the one that I like my list now. So Dingus, it took me a while, but now I'm fond of this officially. So I'm going to go first.
I hate my
list. I'll be introducing the next week's 3x3. My first one. Now, here's the weird thing, too, is I haven't necessarily taken the recommendations. In two of mine, I never saw the movies that were recommended. So I don't
know. Afterwards, even?
Yeah, afterwards. So, for instance, here we go. I'll start out. This is a horror movie from, I think, like 1980 with Dennis Christopher as a creepy movie buff. And it's called Fade to Black. And he's a real nerdy outcast guy, but he loves movies. And he meets a girl that reminds him of Marilyn Monroe, and he wants to go out with her, but she disses him. So he flips out, and he starts murdering people who have antagonized him in the manner of different movies. And I think in Fade to Black, it's almost like Dream On as a slasher film, in that in Dream On, Brian Benben would do takes to the camera, and there'd be a shot of an old movie. In Fade to Black, Dennis Christopher would murder someone while he's imagining scenes from these movies. And it's got footage from Night of the Living Dead. It's got footage. And these are the ones that specifically grabbed my curiosity, and I've still never seen any of these. But there's footage from Jimmy Cagney movies, White Heat and Public Enemy. I've never seen those, and I remember being fascinated by those in the movie. And Dennis Christopher is, you know, he's imagining the scenes from the movie in his head, and I think it's when he's getting gunned down at the end or whatever. But he dresses up as, like, the mummy, as Dracula. He dresses up as, and I had no idea when in 1980 who this was, he dresses up as Hopalong Cassidy, and he guns somebody down. And I think he even eats somebody. And this was before I had ever seen Night of the Living Dead. So I saw scenes from Night of the Living Dead before I actually saw Night of the Living Dead. But the really intriguing bits were from James Cagney movies, which I've still never seen. Isn't it a James Cagney movie where he pushes a woman down a woman in a wheelchair down some stairs? And
that's Eisenstein and Ship Potemkin.
It's a baby carriage. But I think he also fruit into some
oil.
So anyway, that was a movie recommended by Fade to Black, which is this horror movie I loved as a kid, and I never got around to seeing any James Cagney movies. So you guys haven't seen Fade to Black?
It sounds like Peeping Tom.
No. Peeping Tom, I mean, it's okay, got, you know, similarly in that it's like a horror film about this young, disaffected, arty kind of guy, but it's very much just a chintzy slasher movie. Peeping Tom is brilliant. Peeping Tom has got these commentaries on, like, voyeurism and the film industry. Although, you know what, Kelly Wand? Fade to Black, you could make an argument that Fade to Black turns on its head this idea that people can be influenced by movies to do violent things. Like, there's something subversive about Fade to Black saying, yeah, you know what, if you watch violent movies, you might flip out and kill people in the manner of those movies. Don't let, like...
Right.
Yeah, so maybe there is something there, Kelly Wand. But you guys didn't see it. You guys never even heard of this movie? Dennis Christopher, come on, the guy, the Italian kid in Breaking Away. No? Okay.
Oh, I thought he was Father Mulcahy.
Don't know. He was in Deadwood? Oh. Was he in MASH? I don't think
so. MASH, then after MASH. After MASH was so much better than MASH, dude.
Dennis Christopher was the guy who shaved his legs and thought he was Italian in Breaking Away. He was, I think, Paul Dooley's...
Oh, yeah, and then he turned French at the end.
Right, exactly. Buongiorno, Papa. Right.
Surprising.
So that's Dennis Christopher. And right after Breaking Away, he did this silly horror movie.
Really?
Yep.
Don't they usually do things the other way? Like, they make the stupid horror movie and then...
This was the 80s, Kelly Wand. They had whole different rules back then. Yeah.
Hmm.
All right, so there's my number three.
Who's the hottie in it?
An Australian actress who I don't think you've seen before or since, who's a Marilyn Monroe lookalike.
Jenna Malone?
Courage, Anna Kerrigan, maybe something like that. I don't know. No, not Jenna Malone. Jenna Malone was not even conceived yet. She was but a...
Conceiving that.
It's gross.
Right,
so there's my number three. It's White Heat and Public Enemy from Fade to Black. So, Kelly Wand, what is your number three?
All the movies you referenced. Night of the Living Dead, The Mummy.
But it was specifically the Cagney movies. It was the Cagney movies that I keep meaning to watch. Because when I now think of James Cagney, I think of Dennis Christopher doing his impression of James Cagney instead of James Cagney. So these movies were basically referenced in Fade to Black, and I need to get around to seeing a Cagney movie. So,
I think White Heat's the only one I've seen.
Okay, should I see it?
He's like the biggest star ever of that era, and I've only heard of one movie that he's been in.
Yeah, movies back. I don't think movies back then were very good, though. It took a while before movies got
good. Gangster, see? He called everybody dirty rats because they killed his brother. That was worth imitating for 60 years.
Can you give us a line reading on that, Kelly Wand?
You dirty rats, you killed my brother.
You didn't tell my
name. Now do it as Adam Sandler.
You dirty rats, you killed my brother.
Yeah, now do it as
you dirty rats.
Don't
blow
your throat. It's a James Cagney film in another movie, but I'm not going to bring it up in case you guys have it.
My list might be all Cagney movies, so don't try to preempt this. All right, Kelly, what's your number three? Nobody's seen Fade to Black. You guys are useless. Oh, good Lord.
I agree.
Yeah.
What's your number three, Kelly?
I agree with the last part. This is my only good one. It's a little film called Cape Fear with Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte, the remake. And there's a scene where
what are they watching?
Nick Nolte. They go to see Problem Child, which is fascinating to me because Nick Nolte takes his family to see Problem Child, and De Niro is sitting in front of them in the row in front of them and like howling at everything in the movie. Like,
that's a famous scene.
Being obnoxious.
What is Problem
Child? It's a John Ritter movie with a red-haired kid who is maniacal and insane. But it's all comical, even though he almost kills everyone. And
now,
he throws a cat in the dryer.
Is footage Problem Child actually visible, or can you just hear the sounds of Problem Child? Do you actually see the screen?
I think you see Ritter going through a window while the kid drives him through a mall or something.
That's awesome.
And then you hear chicken feathers and tar or something. But the thing I liked about it was you couldn't kill Robert De Niro in Cape Fear because he was just a supernatural villain. And you couldn't kill the Problem Child in Problem Child, even though Ritter wants to smother him in one scene, because he's a kid. So that's my number three.
Ah, so that's why Scorsese picked it. Good, good. Well played.
Also, Scorsese's obviously a fan of the Problem Child trilogy.
He prefers the Beethoven films, but he'll sell it for Problem Child.
They couldn't get the rights. Dingus, what is your number three?
My number three movie recommended by another movie was actually quoted within this movie, so I'm just going to give you the quote. How about that? What do you think of that?
I like it. I like it, see?
God. Wow, that's horrible. That's really bad.
Yeah, shame. I like it.
Oh, God. It's happening still. I better type something. Pretend it's over.
All right, Maya, number three. Here we go. I'll be having the alfalfa sprouts and a plate of mashed yeast.
Oh.
No idea. I haven't seen it.
Tom's dead silent.
I haven't seen it.
That makes me feel better.
I haven't seen it. That's why.
Give us a hint. A line's not a hint.
It's not.
It's a real hint. Give us everything but the title or the initials of the title.
All right. The recommended film is one of my favorite director-writers, and the film that recommends it is one of my least favorite director-writers.
Oh, that explains it.
In fact, somebody I would go so far as to say I despise.
Uh-oh.
And should have made last week's list, actually, now that I think about it.
Kind of a Mel Gibson hater.
Your clues suck, Dingus.
That clue's so convoluted.
You guys will never get it.
I need a slide rule.
I don't know you well enough to know. All right, trigonometry boy. Why don't you just do another line? Do all the lines. Do the whole movie.
See? Yeah, see? Well, I never want to belong to a club that would have me as a member, see? Yeah.
Annie Hall?
Yes.
It was your W.C. Fields as James Cagney? Oh, nice.
I was doing Adam Sandler.
All right. What is your
sex symbol?
Back then, you know, sex was very different back then, Kelly Wand.
So women were totally attracted to that kind of sound coming from a man.
Oh, God.
That's so insensitive of you, Kelly Wand. He had a speech defect. That's why he talked that way.
He did?
Yes.
Really?
No, I just made
it. What did Edward G. Robinson have? Oh, okay.
Dingus, we are no closer to your number three. Your clues suck.
That is fun.
Give us the name of
the movie
and the movie recommended.
Give us one of them and then try and guess the other one.
You're never going to guess the other one, and you already guessed the first one. Can I just talk now?
Talk, sir!
The movie is Annie Hall, as Kelly Wand guessed, a 1977 film directed by Woody Allen. The movie that recommended it to me was a 1985 film directed by one Joel Shoemaker. And that film was St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, God.
It is such a horrible film. What can I do for you?
St. Elmo's Fire references Annie Hall?
Yeah,
it can't be the other way around.
That would be lost. No, actually what happens is Emilio Estevez is obsessed with Andy McDowell, and they went out one time in college. St. Elmo's Fire is about a bunch of losers who have graduated from college and act like dicks. And Emilio Estevez happens upon her when she's working in the emergency room because she's obviously going to be a doctor. She's Andy McDowell. And the first thing he says to her, one of the first things he says is, "Are you still into Woody Allen movies?"
And he arranges a date for them that they're going to have lunch together. And he's been obsessed with her since they went out one time in college, and she can barely remember him. And apparently the one thing they did during their one date in college years ago was go to see Annie Hall together. And as soon as she sits down at the table, he springs on her with this line. It's so pathetic and needy. He says to her, I'll be having the alfalfa sprouts and a plate of mashed yeast. You know, just hoping she'll know what he's talking about. And she goes, really? Are you a vegetarian? And that's totally not what Annie McDowell sounds like, because Glenn Close does her voice in this movie. But she says, oh, I thought we went to see a Mel Brooks film. He goes, no, I'm sure it was Annie Hall. And the reason this worked for me is that I saw this in high school a number of times, because I hung out with a bunch of girls who just loved this movie beyond all reason. It's horrid.
Because Rob Lowe.
Yeah, and he's hot. I mean, there's no way around that.
Well, I remember girls applauded when he turned down the money at one point. Remember that part?
Well, he plays saxophone for about 30 minutes in the middle of the movie, you know, in this sweaty on stage in a bar scene. But I had some experience with Woody Allen from my father. I really only remember watching Take the Money and Run with him. One of his favorite lines is they get one warm meal a week, a bowl of steam. And I just remember him just crying about Take the Money and Run and loving that movie. And I had no other experience with Woody Allen. And then this movie, Annie Hall, was mentioned in this crappy movie. And I eventually finally got to see better Woody Allen films and just fell for him as a director and writer. And this crappy movie is what recommended him to me.
Hmm.
All right.
Moving on.
Annie Hall, Insane Almost Fire. I had no idea that was in there. And if you'd asked me, I would have said that John Hughes directed Insane Almost Fire. I'm glad that to be set
free. No. He didn't handle people that old, of college age.
Okay. My number two is a cartoon. However, in the cartoon, there's live-action footage from – I had to do research and figure this out – Hello, Dolly, which I have never seen. In WALL-E, he's got an old VHS tape of a musical, and it's just like some people back in the, I don't know, 20s or 30s or whatnot, just singing, and one of them's got like a straw hat, and the girl's got some old frilly dress. I don't know what's going on, but it's live-action footage, and for some reason, Andrew Stanton, who directed WALL-E, thought, hey, let's put Hello, Dolly in there. So I love WALL-E. I've never seen Hello, Dolly, but now I'm curious, hey, should I see Hello, Dolly? Have you guys seen Hello, Dolly?
No.
No, but if you care about Andrew Stanton, you should see it, because he loves that.
You know what I did? That's interesting thing is I did some research, and you're right. He was really big on, like, High School Musicals and whatnot, and he wanted this naive idea of love to inform WALL-E. So they were casting about for what musical to use, and he intentionally wanted it to be one that wasn't very well known. And he just hooked on a few lyrics from the two songs that appear. Here's a quote from Andrew Stanton. I do think it was an asset to WALL-E that Hello, Dolly! Is not as well known as other musicals. It became more of an everyman's musical, almost more representative of the overall naive joy that musicals can exude. And I got that sense. I was like, oh, look, how cute. I have no idea what it is, but it's adorable. And I love that it, you know, it's teaching WALL-E that he should hold hands with Eva. What was that? Why would you go, ugh?
I don't like that movie. I don't like WALL-E. I like the character of WALL-E, but I didn't like the movie WALL-E.
You're a terrible person. You're a terrible person, Kelly Warren.
It's no Up. Up's way better.
They're different.
But I don't like the idea of conquering space, and then garbage is still a problem. Like if we just
so you're saying the science, I see. So you disagree with the science of it.
And I don't like the captain's wheel being a villain. No, it's dumb.
The computer, it's Hal. Kelly Warren, I submit that you did not understand WALL-E.
No, Kelly, I didn't.
Kelly, how do you feel about Idiocracy?
Awesome. Best movie ever made.
I'm with you there, Kelly Wand.
And I like the parts of WALL-E where he's on Earth, but then when they get up to the spaceship, I didn't like it anymore.
But you didn't have a problem with the garbage skyscrapers in Idiocracy? Aha.
No.
Okay. Uh-huh. Actually, that does make sense, Dingus, because they're stupid in Idiocracy. They're supposed to be evolved in WALL-E, I think.
But you know what?
Fred, a sequel to the Oscars.
But Fred Willard was in charge, Kelly Wand. How much credit can you give him? Yeah, exactly.
But he conquered space, so he's a genius. Cleaning up garbage shouldn't be too complicated if you can do that. But they never look out the windows of this. Like, they have this awesome spaceship. They should be like, I don't know.
That was a social commentary, Kelly Wand.
I don't like that.
You're a terrible, hard-hearted man to not like Wall-E.
I like him.
Okay.
When it seemed like he was lobotomized, I was like, oh, that's a harsh, awesome ending. And then he's not lobotomized, and the roach lives.
Right.
And I went, yeah, kids movie. Oh, and then the fat guy goes, yeah, man, we can plant chocolate trees. Like, they've learned nothing.
That's the social commentary.
That we've learned nothing? That's a bittersweet ending?
Humanity will devolve if it follows its current course of consumerism.
Yeah. Meanwhile, buy this $12 popcorn and watch Wall-E.
When I went to see Wall-E, I did not buy any popcorn. So
Deliberately.
Exactly. Because of the message of Wall-E. I refused to take part in that. I did not buy a Wall-E toy or lunchbox. So there you go.
The theater concession people, they're like the army recruiters in The Messenger. They're selling the death. Recruiting kids. Evil plot.
I just brought an old shoe to Wall-E.
Very good. All right, Kelly, what is your number two? So none of us here has seen Hello, Dolly, so you guys can't tell me whether or not I should see it. All right. By the way, you'll be glad to know for my number one, I actually watched the movie that the movie recommended. So I'll have
Of this list or because just
no, because when I saw the movie recommended in the movie, I was like, oh, I'm going to watch that. And I did. And I'll let you know how that turned out when it comes to be my turn. But first, Kelly Wand, what is your number two movie recommended by another movie?
All right. My number two is kind of a twofer. It's the nameless Swedish porn movie that Robert De Niro takes Cybill Shepherd to in Taxi Driver, and Taxi Driver is referenced in Zapped when Scott Baio is saying, are you talking to me in the mirror? All right, that's my number two. Go dig it.
Can't stand Wall-E, but can't stop talking about Zapped.
All right.
Zapped is social commentary in an order of magnitude that Wall-E can only dream of.
I'm going to have to see this Zapped movie. I'm going to have to see this thing. And you
Willie Ames is like the Eva character, kind of.
All right.
Or wait, Heather Thomas is like Eva.
I watched Zapped so many times on Cinemax because there were going to be breasts showing up at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I might have prevented this. Wow, how about that? There's nudity in Zapped?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like a shot. There's a camera. There's a camera shot in the dark.
That's the whole point of the movie. Yeah, there's a camera shot in the dark. There's other boobs in it. It's a great film.
That's
an art house film.
That's the boob shot.
Nobody dies in it.
I knew
it
would come up.
Did you actually see it? Gotcha. Well, all my other ones are done.
Because I could watch Zapped. And not worry about my parents coming in and going, what's that? It's Zapped. I mean, that's not like getting it on or something. You know, they wouldn't know that there would be boobs coming. It's Zapped.
What's a movie called Getting It On?
Yeah, Tom Cruise? No, that's Losing It. Wait, what's Getting It On?
All the Right Moves. No.
I have no idea. I just made that up.
Is Getting It On the one where they go to Mexico, Tom Cruise and Shelley Long?
I have no idea.
The Mexican.
I just made some words together.
Kelly Wand, you're thinking of The Mexican.
I like the sound Dingus made when I inevitably said Zapped. It was just like, oh, God.
I'm surprised you didn't save it for your number one.
It is the sound of inevitability.
I don't have a number one.
Kelly Wand, when you were talking about Swedish porn, I thought you were going to reference the one in Big Lebowski with Peter Stormare coming to fix the cable.
You
know what happens next? He fixes the cable?
No, Gutterballs.
Yes. Was that Gutterballs? Gutterballs was a dream. But was it actually the name of...
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Porn with Peter Stormare?
Yeah, you're right. He made it a bowling porno, because that was his thing.
But
I like the Lost finale. Spoiler alert.
All right, Dingus, what is your number two?
Dingus hates. Smart man.
List is so useless. All right, I'm going to quote the recommending movie. See if you blokes can get it.
ooh, now she's low maintenance.
Hmm. When Harry met Sally.
Very good.
I'll have what she's having.
Right. How did you know that? You recognized a When Harry Met Sally quote.
Wow. Well, that's the only movie I can think of where they have the conversation about low maintenance. I mean, that's one of the famous scenes from that movie that I hate, by the way. What movie do they reference in When Harry Met Sally?
Yeah.
You've got to be kidding me.
I don't remember.
Let's...
Casablanca? Didn't they always reference Casablanca in every movie?
Really? Oh, I hate When Harry Met Sally even more. So, okay, well, go ahead, Dingus. Explain the
Every movie has Casablanca in it.
That's true.
That's cheating. That's not fair. That's a cheap cop-out. You're a terrible man.
What is the
another movie that has Casablanca in it?
Play It Again, Sam.
Yes.
No, Zapped. It doesn't. Just references it. Yeah.
Zapped. Stop it with Zapped.
All right. Yeah. Unfortunately, When Harry Met Sally just does not stand up at all.
Uh-huh.
It's so painful to watch again. And I tried because I wanted to see these scenes. And sometimes when one of the things I love, and I've said this before about 3x3 is you put a movie in, just going to watch a little bit of it, and this is what happened with Casablanca, and what happens every time I go by Casablanca is that I have to watch the whole thing, and I just freaking love that movie. And I've come to love it more and more every time I see it. It doesn't wear on me at all, and I see new things about it every time I see it. And so I watched it again this week just so I could get another feel for it, and I watched the whole thing. It's so easy to watch. And I hadn't seen it before seeing When Harry Met Sally. And so, in a way, you're right, Kelly. It is sort of, what's our favorite word, facile, to reference a classic movie like Casablanca as the movie these characters are talking about. And they talk about it in reference to sexuality, and they have a bonding moment when they're both watching it together but separately.
Oh, God, that's right. Ugh.
And When Harry Met Sally really is painful to watch again. The early scenes, they are just horrible. The acting is terrible in it, and it's just painful and cute,
and predictable,
and so artificial.
And they have no obstacles.
It was a movie I loved at first when I first saw it in 1989, but it is so artificial now. But
everyone, Batman.
At least it introduced me to Casablanca, which I had avoided in much the same way that I avoided Citizen Kane, because I just sort of assumed it was another film that geezer critics would throw on their top 10 of all time list out of laziness, because they felt like they had to, because these are classic films. And while I've watched Citizen Kane a number of times and never fully gotten it, I don't think, Casablanca I get more and more every time I see it. It's just such a beautifully done movie, and I'm appreciative of When Harry Met Sally for making me go ahead and watch it, because I thought, well, this is the kind of movie that these two characters, if they're going by, if they're cruising by on cable, they'll stop and watch, because that's what happens in the scene. One of them calls the other one, and Sally's watching it, and Harry asks what she's doing, and she says she's watching that, and he goes, "Channel, please." And he switches over to that channel. And I get the feeling like these people will watch this movie no matter when, no matter what. And there are certain movies like that for me, too, that if I'm walking by a TV in a store and it's on, I'll stop and watch it. Or, you know, I don't really surf channels anymore because TiVo doesn't really sort of eliminate that from your life. But if there's a chance for a 3x3, for instance, and I put the movie in, I'm going to watch the whole movie. And Casablanca is one of those movies.
So I'll tell you a better movie, Dingus, that references Casablanca. Barbed Wire with Pamela Anderson. It is a remake. It's a remake of Casablanca. No lie.
Huh.
There you go.
True story.
Who's
Ingrid
Bergman?
Pamela Anderson. Oh no, she's the Bogart. Let's see. Who is? I'm sure there's some dude like, I don't know, Martin Henderson or someone like that, who is the equivalent of Ingrid Bergman. But it is. It's a Casablanca remake. So.
So when Harry Met Sally, the whole big plot point is, at the beginning, she says she would take the Paul Henreid character from Casablanca, but by the end, she'd take the Bogart character, and she doesn't remember saying what she said earlier. So they're trying to tell us, and that Robert Reiner's point is, see, Billy Crystal's just like Humphrey Bogart, same thing.
I think Billy Crystal's more like the Peter Lorre character. Okay, my number one, you guys ready for this?
It's good.
So this is one where I saw this movie. I loved this movie. It mentioned another movie. I'm like, okay, for further insight into the character, I'm going to rent this movie that's recommended, which I did. And it was terrible. I couldn't believe it, and I felt dirty and weird watching it. So a movie came out a couple years ago called Breach, which is about sting operation that the FBI mounted to catch a guy named Robert Hansen, who they suspected of selling secrets to the Russians. So they hire a young fellow named Eric O'Neill, who goes undercover and reveals what Robert Hansen is doing. It was eventually successful. Hansen was arrested. So in the movie, Chris Cooper plays Robert Hansen, and Ryan Phillippe, who's very, very good in this. And he doesn't get enough credit. Ryan Phillippe is great, and he's especially good in Breach. He plays Eric O'Neill, and it's this fantastic cat and mouse between those two characters. But one of the historical details of Robert Hansen is that he was obsessed with Catherine Zeta-Jones. And there's an episode in the movie. You actually see at one point in the movie that he's got the DVD of Entrapment, you know, the Sean Connery Catherine Zeta-Jones in his possessions. But there's a scene in the movie where he calls Eric O'Neill into his office, and he's got his laptop open, and he's watching Entrapment. And he calls Eric O'Neill over, and he points out Catherine Zeta-Jones and makes some sort of lascivious remark about her. Mm-hmm. Just, like, so weird and out of character. And I think on the commentary track, the actual Eric O'Neill did the commentary track for the movie. The actual Eric O'Neill said that when that happened, that Robert Hansen was actually masturbating in his office when he called him over to look at Catherine Zeta-Jones. So I was like, that's just weird. That's gross. Okay, I got to see this movie now.
Oh, my God.
So that was my background for renting. I knew nothing
about
it.
So good you'll masturbate to it.
And Entrapment is so weird and creepy and inappropriate because Sean Connery is like 80, and Catherine Zeta-Jones is really hot and young and lithe, and she squirms through lasers and security systems and whatnot, and then she makes out with Sean Connery, and it's just so, it was just icky. It made my skin crawl. So that's my number one, is Entrapment as recommended by Breach.
That would be the last Catherine Zeta-Jones movie I'd masturbate to, by the way.
Well, you're obviously not Robert Hansen.
Blue is Juice awesome. Is good, and Splitting Hairs. She's naked.
Tom,
and the old man in that is Eric Idle. Like, she has sex with Eric Idle, like old Eric Idle.
Well, it is an art recalling life because she's married to Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas. She likes gray pubes.
I totally forgot that appeared in that movie and that you had even mentioned this before. That's awesome. And it's especially awesome if you remember the character, the Hansen character, and how buttoned down and repressed he was, you know, in his relationship with his wife. That's awesome. I love that.
And that's the one.
Breach good?
Breach is awesome, Kelly Wong. Breach is
great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, great.
It made both of our lists that year, so I heartily recommend Breach. Breach is great.
And Ryan Phillippe is so good. How do you say his name? Is it Philippe? Felipe? I don't know how you say his name.
Oh, I thought I'd give him the little flourish at the end to help sell him. So
his MacGruber bombed. You feel bad for him?
You know what? So most people, when I would say, I don't want to see MacGruber, they would go, but Val Kilmer is in it, which I don't necessarily see as a so much as Ryan Phillippe being in it. I would rather see Ryan Phillippe playing the straight man to whatever the dude is from Saturday Night Live to his goofy MacGruber character. All right, so Kelly Wand, what is your number one movie recommended by another movie?
My number one movie recommended by another movie. Wait, so the first one is the recommended movie, and the second one is. Okay. The recommended movie is John Ford 1952 movie called The Quiet Man, which should have been a contender for Best Fight, because there's a really good fight in The Quiet Man. You guys see it? John Wayne movie?
I've never seen it. Yeah.
Ireland. There's a really awesome fight. But the movie that references it is E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which I hate having as number one on any list. I'm just embarrassed by that. But I love that one scene in E.T. where E.T. gets super drunk on beer, and he watches The Quiet Man, and, like, Elliot's possessed, and he lets all the frogs go, and then he stands on a fat kid to kiss Erica Eleniak. Because E.T. is watching this John Wayne movie. I just can't picture that happening now, like a kid's movie having something that complicated, like some weird... It was a really weird juxtaposition of stuff for such like a silly... I don't know. That's my number one. Sorry.
That's a good one.
Hate myself.
It's wonderful, yeah.
The times I masturbated to that scene.
Whoa.
I'm at the boxing match. I'm not nothing weird. And the alien drinking beer is hot, too. Oh, God, he's talking still. One. Hooray.
I just want to see where you're going to go.
We're just letting you run, Kelly Watch.
Nowhere fast. Yeah, expectant silence. Okay. And he's done. No, he's still doing it. One, two, three. Horrible.
See? Good, good. Dingus, what is your number one for your own list?
My number one movie recommended by another one was quite a surprise to me. It just happened this week. And I'll give you a quote from the recommending film, because this is why I actually watched this film again to see if this would work out. This quote almost wound up on my quotes that should be famous list, just to irk Tom. And this film also almost wound up on my best fight list. So here's the quote from the recommending movie. What's down there? Fucking rancor?
I saw
what's
this.
Down there? Fucking rancor. All right, I know the obvious part. What's down there? Fucking rancor. It's down there. Tremor. Oh, wait. Hills Have Eyes 2, because there's like a pit or something, right? Is it a desert-themed movie?
No.
Is it a snow-themed movie? Whiteout.
Not snow.
Things that are green. Oh.
Something that would be interesting to you, Kelly Wand.
Oh, Willie Ames movie? Paradise.
No, it's a film. The recommending film is a film called Pineapple Express.
I got that one. Damn it.
And I watched Pineapple Express again, hoping that there would be – that I could sort of stretch this Return of the Jedi thing with what's down there, fucking rancor. And I also remembered that Seth Rogen says something about, fuck Jeff Goldblum at some point early in the film. And I thought, well, maybe there's some sort of reference to The Fly. So I'm watching the film. And instead, there's this great moment where Seth Rogen goes to James Franco's apartment to, buy the titular Pineapple Express. And James Franco has two TVs on in his house and satellite radio. And Seth Rogen goes, two TVs and satellite radio. I'm entertained. And James Franco goes to get his scale. One of the TVs is on a television show. I think it's The Jefferson. And the other one is on a movie, and that movie is on mute. And I didn't notice this the first time I saw it, but James Franco leaves the room, and you hear Seth Rogen from the other room say, crawl.
Awesome.
And then they get back, and James Franco sits down, and over his shoulder you see, indeed, that is Krull playing on the muted TV set for some bizarre reason. So I went ahead and rented Krull and watched it again. I haven't seen it since... Probably since I saw it in 1983, I would think, in a theater with my dad. And I loved it. It's so stupid and cheesy. But it was so great to watch it again, especially because I immediately recognized James Horner's Wrath of Khan score that he's I forget which comes first. Well, he's one of the other. He's quoting his own score. You can hear Wrath of Khan in this score for Krull, and it's possible Krull came first, actually. But Krull really works in a lot of ways, even though it's sort of relentlessly cheesy. And Liam Neeson is great in it too. It's just got so many great things, and I was just so happy to watch it again. And it was all because of Pineapple Express.
Okay, I'm putting Krull and Zapped on my list.
Is Krull the name of the planet or that awesome shuriken that keeps flinging around? And I forgot that line because I was so baked during Pineapple Express. I remember a single line after I saw it. Spoiler alert.
It's the name of the planet, the thing that he has, the glaive.
Planet Krull.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Wow.
Great. And the thing that he throws around is the glaive. Because I always remember, I think it's Gordon Cameron who talks about – he had a post about finagling the glaive in World of Warcraft, and that made me think of the glaive.
I thought a glaive was like a spear thing.
A glaive is already something, yeah. I think they appropriated a pre-existing word.
And made it into a completely different weapon.
Well, you know,
well,
they're on a different planet, right. Yeah, they can do
planet Krull.
Right.
I can see where the name of the planet's the most important part of the story. And you'd want to know. Where does it take place? That's all I care about. I don't care.
That'll pack them into the theater.
Oh, it's on Krull. Oh, hey. Finally. Something for me.
Good.
And apparently, I did a minor bit of research, and apparently David Gordon Green's next movie has something of a Krull flair to it. That's all I'm going to say.
What? Well, you can't leave that hanging. What does it? How does it have a Krull flair?
Yeah, that's a cock tease.
Yeah, that's what I'm all about.
How does it have a Krull flair? What makes it a...
Who's David Cameron Johnson again? Who are you talking about?
He's the guy that did Pineapple Express.
Oh. I thought it was the guy who did Krull. I'm like, wait, there's a Krull spin-off? Krull the press.
What makes David Gordon Green's next movie have a Krull flair?
Let me see if I can remember. The movie is called Your Highness. I think it might have Danny McBride in, but I could be wrong about that. But it's a medieval action film. It's a fantasy film.
And
it's in the 80s. And it's
you've sold me.
It's inspired by Krull, and I think he said something else. Beastmaster, maybe? I don't know.
Mark Singer and Ferrets. Yeah, awesome.
Tanya Roberts was so much better as a brunette. There, I said it. Do we have any runners up? Because I have a couple.
I actually had a hard time coming up with one. Kelly, when you were talking, I remember being curious about the John Wayne movie that we see in Running Scared, where Carl Rodan, this great Czech actor, plays an abusive father who envisions himself as John Wayne. And when he sacrifices himself, at one point he basically emulates something that happens in a John Wayne movie. And they have footage from that movie of John Wayne getting shot. And I don't even know what the movie was, but I remember when you talked about E.T., it made me curious when I saw Running Scared. It's, I should see what that John Wayne movie is all about.
Oh, you mean Running Scared, the Billy Crystal movie?
Oh, good Lord.
Gregory Hines. He's our Bogart, I heard.
What were your other ones, Kelly Wand?
In Annie, where they watch Camille. Wait, that's my crappy one that I don't really care about. Did you ever see this Diane Keaton documentary called Heaven?
Oh, I know about it. Yeah, I haven't seen it, though.
They keep there's all these clips of Metropolis and, like, this hot chick from that old Fritz Lang movie, and that made me want to see Metropolis. And also Hannah and Her Sisters, where he goes to see Duck Soup, and he cheers up because he thinks he has terminal illness, and then he sees Duck Soup.
That's actually a very good one, and it not only shows, it not only recommends Duck Soup, but it presents Duck Soup and the Marx Brothers in general as the answer to the existential dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that's quite a recommendation, by the way.
Subtext, and also The Aviator made me want to see Hell's Angels and the Outlaw because I got the sense since he was so horny in that movie that there was probably a lot of TNA, so I saw, which there was. I mean, in the 40s.
Wait, what? What's the connection there?
What? What do you mean?
What's the connection between those movies? And The Aviator, the movie about Howard Hughes?
Yeah. Well, he directed or produced, I forget, Hell's Angels, that plane movie he's making at the beginning where he keeps remaking it. And,
Right.
Color, and he does it like for 6 years. And then he also made The Outlaw, and then he's like, he has a physicist come in and defend the size of Jane Russell's breasts.
Okay.
Explains why it's legally feasible. I have seen The Outlaw, but I haven't seen Hell's Angels, but I want to. Because I want to see what, like, this was what he was satisfied with eventually.
Right.
And the plane footage of the Aviator is so awesome at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's so crazy and wild.
Dingus, what were your runners-up?
Well, what put me over the edge to go ahead and choose this list, because I thought it would be too difficult. But then two films that I'd seen recently, including one podcast film we did, had scenes from other movies in it or referenced other movies. And the movie I'd seen most recently was The Informant. And he talks about The Firm and goes to see The Firm. He says, that's not what happened to The Firm. And it's great the way he talks about The Firm in that movie. And, of course, 44-inch chest, of course, has footage from Samson the Delilah.
Ah, right.
But the one that was hard for me to leave off and got displaced by Kroll was On the Waterfront, which is featured prominently in Raging Bull. I think that's it. There was an outside chance for Lost Boys because of that fleeting quote in Reservoir Dogs, but I couldn't bring myself to watch another Joel Schumacher film.
What is the quote in What is the quote in Reservoir Dogs?
I'm not going to do it. It would involve saying bad words.
And in an accent, too, I believe.
That's right. I know what you're trying to do.
I want to hear it, Dingus. Come on.
Fucker, I'm trying to watch Lost Boys.
Very good. So, Dingus, you think that list was hard, that 3x3. I'm about to hit you guys with a pretty tough one, I think.
I know.
And it's inspired by the movie we saw for this episode.
Mm.
What I want from you guys, and Kelly, or actually one of you, I think, touched on this earlier. What I want from you guys are three movies that feature romances where the characters never even kiss.
Oh, I like it. I know one.
Okay, good. It's going to be tough, though. Yeah.
I got two.
And I think Dingus is going to steal mine, unfortunately. So anyway,
okay.
Put that in your pipe.
So close. This is so close.
This is your way of...
This is great.
It's your way of getting me to not do Zapped because they do kiss in it.
There you go. Exactly.
Jerks.
But you've got some leeway to game that, so, you know, do with it as you will. I think you know what I'm getting at, and you can either go in that direction or do something else. But what I want, three movies that feature romances in which the characters never even kiss. So there you go.
They can have sex.
If that's the way you want to take it. But you know specifically what I'm thinking of is... You know, where that romantic tension is never broken, where it remains throughout and it doesn't become a sexual situation.
Like us, except for the last part.
Wait, what did you just say? Where it doesn't become a sexual situation?
Where it doesn't, I think Kelly Wan was wanting to do an end run where they don't kiss and instead they just go straight to having sex.
And then he went, sure, no problem, except, nope, you can't do that.
No, you can do that, if you want to game it that way, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
I love this one. I love it.
All right, good. So we'll see what you guys come up with next week. Next week, let's see Prince of Persia. What do you guys think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be awesome.
Gemma Arterton, I guess.
Best. Jake Gyllenhaal's really Persian. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, yeah, there's a big article today. People are mad about Whitey playing different races. Last Airbender, too.
So good. Well, we'll see that, and it'll be awesome. And we'll be back here next week to talk about it. And we'll also be bringing you our new 3x3. So I am Tom Chick. I was joined by Christian McCrackley, I think. Am I reading that right?
Release the McCrackley. It's Murawski.
Oh, I was so close. And also Kelly Wand.
Release the Kraken, see? Chris O'Donnell's Tom's Bogart.